Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mom. So I've got a question for you. What is your favorite scent?
I would have to say, like, fresh plants, grass.
This is producer Sam chatting to her mum. And it's a bit of a trick, because Sam absolutely knew she was going to say grass.
I remember having these, like, grass-scented candles growing up. I was just wondering if you have anything around the house that has grass scent or cut grass smell.
I do. I have two things. I have hand soap and I have dish soap.
You know, we had this pretty big yard growing up. I was trying to remember how often we used to mow it. I mean, mostly you used to mow it. Was it, like, every 2 weeks?
Oh, no. I usually mow twice a week. I do half of it and then I do the other half.
Sam's mum, Anne, actually has a degree in horticulture, but the real reason she likes the smell of freshly cut grass is probably a bit closer to home. It's probably just because she's American.
You know, if you have a lawn, it means that you're participating in the American dream. You're an American homeowner. You have a piece of America, almost, this little lawn.
The neatly mown lawn is a hallmark of American suburbia. And yet, where it came from is just about as un-American as you can get.
That style of gardening was associated with absolute monarchy.
What you have on display in your lawn can be pretty revealing.
Eventually you get this kind of working class lawn, which is basically like kind of a postage stamp. And that's where the pink flamingos appear.
A lawn can feel like a little oasis, our very own patch of nature. But what purpose is it really serving?
There's lots of lawn out there that is only walked on when it's mowed. And that's the lawn that we want to get rid of.
I'm Rachel Stewart. Welcome to Don't Drink the Milk, The Curious History of Things. Today, we're uncovering the tangled history of the lawn and what it tells us about how we see ourselves, our neighbors, and our relationship with Mother Nature.
Chinese whispers.
Telefono senza fili.
Telephone.
Kulak tam kulak.
Isporcini telefon.
Telefono arabe.
Uche telefon.
Russian scam.
Don't drink the milk.
So we're here doing an episode about the history of lawns.
Cool.
Can we ask you a couple of questions?
Sure.
Do you guys have a yard or a lawn back home?
Yes, we do. We do. Mm-hmm.
Does it look anything like these lawns?
No, it does not.
Exactly. No, no. I would say definitely not.
So do you guys have a yard or a lawn?
We do. Meet my gardener.
Hello.
And it doesn't look like this yet. But
yet. I'm working on it.
Do you have a yard back home?
I don't. I live in a condominium. We have a ground crew.
And if you think about the classic yards or lawns that you know from back home, do they look anything like what you've seen today?
Oh, well, close. No, kidding. Of course not. Of course not. And when I looked out here, the very first thing I said to my son is these are so manicured. You know, kind of the almost ornamental, if you will.
So you prefer maybe a little bit more of a natural style?
Yeah, I think so. You look out over the wall and you think, whoa. But there's something, it's not artificial exactly.
Sam and I are bothering American tourists in one of Europe's most famous gardens, the Gardens of Versailles, just outside of Paris. And it really does seem very pruned.
Topiary.
I don't like topiary.
I had to Google what it was.
Yeah, these like weirdly shaped bushes.
They're very strange.
It's like a poodle.
Oh, yeah.
Where you sort of feel a bit sorry for the dog.
Yeah.
That they look so silly.
Sorry for the trees.
Definitely.
We are at the beginning, like the king, Louis XIV, loved to begin the visit.
Véronique Ciampini is a landscape engineer here. So we can see all of these sculpted bushes, the topiary, but there are also gilded fountains and perfectly manicured grass as far as the eye can see. Fit for a king, you might say.
So it symbolized the power of the King Louis XIV.
King Louis XIV, also known as the Sun King, moved to Versailles in 1661. And he commissioned this famous French landscape architect, André Le Nôtre, to design the palace's gardens.
André Le Nôtre understood that the gardens are political gardens, and it's a way for the king to say to the court, and all visitors that all is in order.
Well, there's no denying that things look extremely orderly in this garden. In particular, those neat stretches of lawn known as the tapis vert.
The tapis vert is a piece of grass, and it's also a link between the palace and the gardens.
Tapis vert might literally mean green carpet, but it's not for walking on or sinking your toes into.
So a tapis vert, even though it's called a tapis,
no,
is not for walking.
No. It's just a tapis like embroidery tapestry.
interesting, it's more like a tapestry than a carpet. Yeah. Okay.
As we see here in Versailles, the lawn became ornamental and a kind of status symbol. But it grew out of something very different.
Okay, the evolution of grassy patches. I'm ready for it, Sam. What can you tell us about what came before the lawn as we know it?
So earlier patches of grass were often more practical. Pastures, meadows, village greens, town commons. Places where people could graze their animals. Though some patches were more for enjoyment.
Well, it's interesting. If you look at medieval images, paintings and tapestries, you often see people sitting on grass. But if you look closely at the grass, there's all kinds of other plants in there. This is sometimes described as the flowery mead. Mead, I suppose, from the same root as meadow. But you would find things like daisies and violets and clover and strawberries in there, for example.
That's Ian Thompson. He's a retired landscape architect who taught at Newcastle University in the UK.
Would everybody have had their own flowery mead?
Not exactly. So this was back in the Middle Ages when small kingdoms around Europe were constantly at war with one another. They built up castles, well, fortresses, really, with tall walls to keep invaders out. And in the middle of these castle grounds would be a courtyard. And perhaps a flowery mead.
So how did we get from this to lawns?
The thing about castles, at a certain point, the walls became useless.
The turning point comes when war settles down across Europe and rulers no longer need castle walls to protect against invasion.
By the Tudor period, people are building palaces or houses rather than castles. And they have extensive gardens. And that's really when lawns come into their own.
The walls came down and the gardens moved out. Instead of hiding and protecting what you had, it became more about putting your wealth on display. And one man who had plenty of wealth to put on display was Louis XIV.
I think the purpose of Louis XIV was to create gardens to show his power over the world.
How exactly do you use your garden to show your power over the world? Well, we already know Louis was using Versailles to show how orderly everything was in his court. The design also makes use of straight lines and perspective to draw your eye to the horizon, as if the grounds go on to infinity. And things got even more philosophical.
Après, plus globalement, ce qui va être mis à l'apogée à Versailles, c'est la maîtrise.
Véronique is saying that what's highlighted at Versailles is a command of nature. In 17th century Europe, ideas about humans' relationship with nature were changing. One really influential idea came from French philosopher René Descartes. He argued that nature is separate from man, and it's there to be conquered. This idea would endure for centuries.
Puisqu'à l'époque, la nature est plutôt considérée comme hostile, dangereuse pour l'homme.
Véronique explains that nature was seen as something hostile and dangerous. There were harsh winters and devastating famines. So Louis XIV wanted to prove that he was in control. That's why pretty much everything we can see around us here is green. There are mostly evergreen varieties of shrubs and, of course, grass. Nothing much that would bloom in spring or lose its leaves in winter. The king was showing that he was above the seasons, above nature. And it turns out the king was quite a trendsetter. Versailles ushered in a new era of gardens. Free from castle walls, its open spaces offered clean lines, sculpted greenery, and formal geometric designs. And lawns, just for decoration.
It was a big influence in France and all over Europe.
Aristocrats brought the Versailles gardening trend to their own palaces in France, Germany, Italy. But not everyone was a fan. You see, the French garden style is quite particular. Remember all that topiary?
You know, it's a very artificial garden.
Artificial and a bit royalist?
There was a sort of revulsion against that in Britain, and it was partly political because that style of gardening was associated with absolute monarchy. In Britain, we'd got rid of absolute monarchy, and they were looking for a style which was different from the autocratic sort of French style.
The Brits threw out the straight lines and symmetry for a different style.
It's much more naturalistic. In fact, one of the criticisms that was levelled at that style of garden was that it was so much like nature that you sometimes couldn't differentiate between nature and the garden.
Green rolling hills and meadows, the occasional sprinkling of trees. This English style was much, much less formal than any French garden. I think of the grounds of Downton Abbey or countless stately homes in Jane Austen novels.
Remember that famous Le Nôtre guy in France? Well, Britain's answer to him was a pioneering landscape architect called Lancelot Brown, better known by the nickname Capability.
Incidentally, his name Capability comes from when he visited a new client. He would walk the grounds or ride the grounds with the owner. And then he would say, yes, I think it's got capabilities. That word then meant something like, we might say, potential today.
With all that potential, he would redesign landscapes with man-made lakes and streams, artificial hills, newly planted trees, and a few dead ones for that realistic look. And of course, everything was connected with expanses of green lawn. So while this style looked very natural, it was actually very engineered.
It also sounds very expensive.
Well, there was one built-in cost saver.
Compared with the French style, it was much cheaper to maintain because, you know, the animals in the park did most of the work. They were the lawnmowers.
Okay,
oh,
so
wow.
Oh, this is what I wanted you to see.
Oh my god, they're so cute.
Okay, Rachel, so this is the Queen's Hamlet.
Oh my god, I love it. I want to move in.
Back in Versailles, I've brought Rachel to a corner of the gardens I think she might like.
Do you feel at home amongst this little village of cottages?
I mean, I can't say I've ever lived in a house that looks like this, but they look super cute, and maybe some of my ancestors did.
The Queen's Hamlet has a very different vibe to what we've seen so far.
Look at those pumpkins!
Wow!
Storybook cottages with thatched roofs and vegetable patches bursting with leeks and leafy cabbage.
I really expect, like, the birds and bunnies to start talking to us or something.
Yeah, they're going to come out of those little holes.
Yeah.
By the late 18th century, France was on to their 16th King Louis. You've probably heard of his wife, Marie Antoinette. Well, this French queen became a fan of gardening trends developing across the English Channel. More messy, more wild, more...
just super quaint. Almost too quaint.
Mm.
Like, they've gone a little bit too far, I'd say. I feel like we've entered a theme park. I mean, if you were the Queen of France, this would feel like a proper getaway.
Because, as Veronique told us, this place was a kind of escape from the extreme orderliness of Versailles. Here, nature looked more natural.
Of course, whether it was French kings taming the seasons, English aristocrats moulding the landscape, or Marie Antoinette making a mini England in her garden, they were all still imposing their will on nature, and showing that they had the power and the money to do so.
And that instead of using your land for something practical, like farming, you could afford to use that land just for show. Which doesn't sound so far off from the lawns I know back home.
One thing to bear in mind is that the founding fathers of America were essentially very English in their tastes and attitudes, weren't they?
We might have broken away from English rule, but we didn't manage to break away from English garden rule.
George Washington at Mount Vernon, he ordered the creation of a bowling green and a deer park. And I understand that he imported English grass seed. Thomas Jefferson at Monticello did similarly, and he also laid out the University of Virginia. And it has a feature called the lawn, and there's an academic village arranged around it.
But most people weren't Washington or Jefferson. Ordinary homes didn't have bowling greens or a deer park or lawns out front. In fact, they were usually very close to the street with an enclosed garden in the back, not unlike middle-class homes in Europe. The transition to big front lawns came about later, with the help of two major developments. First, another English invention.
The first lawnmower was invented by a couple of guys called John Ferriby and Edwin Budding.
The inspiration for the lawnmower was a machine that used a rotating cylinder to trim extra fluff from woolen cloth so it would be smooth to the touch.
And they made the creative leap and saw that the same technology, this rotating blade, could be used in a cylinder mower to cut grass.
The first version, patented in 1830, was pulled by horses. It was followed by a steam mower and then a gasoline-powered mower in 1902. So the lawnmower made it easier to mow a lawn, but people still needed a lawn to mow, which was quite rare for the average person until a fellow by the name of Frederick Law Olmsted came along and designed a suburb of Chicago called Riverside. Olmsted proposed that houses should be set back from the road by 30 feet.
You know, that set out the sort of pattern of having these front yards, which could be grass. So you weren't supposed to hide your lawn away. You were supposed to display it to everyone.
It's worth noting that Olmsted also designed Central Park in New York City. And similar to English country estates, Central Park is very man-made, but meant to look very natural. In the suburbs, Olmsted was going for a similar park-like vibe. So the idea is that one home's front yard continues into the next with uninterrupted grass. And that really distinguished the American middle-class yard from those back in Europe.
I would probably characterize it and say that the English lawn is still pretty much a private affair. We also like to have hedges or walls. Whereas typically American yards, they're probably bigger. And the lawns are visible to the rest of the street.
So just like the gardens of the French royals and then the English gentry, the American front yard eventually became like a kind of exhibition space?
Exactly. And if you're going to put your garden on display, you better be prepared for some judgy neighbors.
Oh, yes.
The rise of suburbs came with homeowners associations, covenants, and municipal ordinances, all imposing rules on your home and garden. Breaking those rules can have serious consequences, even today.
Man gets $30,000 fine for not mowing grass.
Boys mow lawn to keep elderly Texas woman out of jail.
Grand Prairie man goes to jail for overgrown lawn.
So lawns become this incredibly important battleground for taste.
This is Jenny Price, a writer and environmental historian.
Now, taste is a really interesting idea. I think everybody sort of feels like they know what taste is. But if you really ask, well, like, what is taste? It's actually kind of hard to answer.
But, of course, that didn't stop many people from trying to answer it for themselves. In 1870, a guy named Frank Jessup Scott wrote The Art of Beautifying Suburban Home Grounds.
And it's all about keeping the lawn tasteful, which means basically keeping it natural. And he is obsessed with, you know, you have to keep it simple. You have to keep it natural. You can't overload your lawn with figures and vases and flowers and things like that. The closer you get to the house, the more okay it is to have a few of these things. And the farther you get from the house, the more it's absolutely essential it is to keep that, you know, a bastion of nature.
And that particular notion of taste had staying power.
Anybody from anywhere in the world who's driven through an American suburb will see that a lawn is a piece of grass, basically. It's basically a piece of grass with nothing on it. Americans, this is a very class-oriented thing, again, and generally do not approve of putting anything in your front yard. No chairs, no lawn ornaments, no anything.
Jenny says a minimal but freshly mown front lawn is a clear marker of taste in middle-class America.
Where you have money and you can buy things, you can buy really nice clothes and you can have a really big lawn, but you show that you have restraint, right? So it's just kind of you're showing that you have wealth, but you also have restraint as opposed to the excesses of the, you know, of the elite upper class.
So you don't want to be as ostentatious as the royals in Versailles, but you also don't want to be at the other end of the spectrum, which I guess would be represented by
maybe a pink flamingo.
Yeah, well, the pink flamingo starts off with this actually quite straightforward set of meanings. It's a lawn ornament, and it's a kind of working class tradition to buy these kind of what a lot of people would call tacky lawn ornaments. And it's pink, and it's glitzy, and it's it has some kind of more straightforward meanings among working class homeowners who put them out on their lawns in the 50s and 60s, that I own a piece of America, basically, and I am participating in the American dream.
After World War II, low-cost mortgages for veterans, white veterans, that is, made the American dream of owning a home with a yard accessible to many more Americans. For those who could afford it, that meant a big house with a big lawn. For others, that meant something a bit smaller. If you're a working-class homeowner with a small house and a tiny lawn, it makes sense that you might want to jazz it up a little bit.
I started looking into the history of plastic pink flamingos, and I actually decided ultimately that it tells us just about as much about American ideas of nature as any other topic I've ever run across.
Once again, we've come back to the question of what is natural? Natural being a marker of taste. For many, a plastic lawn ornament modeled after a real animal didn't fit the bill.
It's absolutely excoriated by art critics. You know, it's plastic, and of course plastics become a symbol of what's unnatural. So plastic, and then it's pink, this kind of neon pink, and it's a flamingo. And a flamingo, I mean, you might find a duck on a lawn, but you're not going to find a flamingo on a lawn in New Jersey.
These plastic birds are a brighter shade of pink than the real deal. And whether displayed sincerely or with a bit of irony, they seem to always be associated with being fake, unreal, or unnatural.
So it becomes this symbol of what is not nature. But ironically, the plastic flamingo, just like everything, is made out of nature. My books, my computer, you know, the toothpicks, my phone, everything is made out of nature. It's made out of petroleum and wood and, you know, natural materials, because nature is the stuff with which we create our lives. So is the plastic pink flamingo. I mean, I've been to the factory and you see these polyethylene crystals that they use that are tinged with petroleum-based dyes, and they turn that into the plastic flamingo, and then they use steel for the legs. That's ore that comes out of the ground. And a plastic flamingo is nature incarnate.
Whoa, 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 whoa. So Jenny is saying that the plastic flamingo is nature because essentially all the materials that go into making it originally derived from nature.
Yes.
Wow. But couldn't you just say that about anything?
Exactly. A simple plastic lawn ornament brings us back to our old friend Descartes. Rather than nature and the human world being separate, as he argues, Jenny is saying that everything in our lives, plastic or otherwise, comes from nature. And therefore, we're not so separate after all.
It's very pernicious because it allows us to think that nature is this place apart rather than nature is the foundation of our lives.
Mind blown.
Jenny even argues that if you're going to point fingers at something for being man-made, maybe it should be at the lawn.
What's interesting about the lawn is that it's supposed to be this bastion of nature, but it requires an enormous amount of human labor, right? You have to create it first. You have to irrigate it. You have to blast it with pesticides. I mean, environmentally, it's a total disaster. It's like one non-native species that supports essentially no wildlife, and it requires a lot of water, and it's loaded with pesticides. It's the most unnatural thing you could think of, actually, and it's really ironic.
We'll be right back.
I'm Rob Norman.
I'm Andrew Norton.
And on Personal Best, we help you tackle the stuff you'd be too embarrassed to ask an attractive, successful life coach about.
That's right. We have a slightly different approach to self-improvement.
Which is, we don't know what we're doing.
Definitely somebody following me.
Okay, she's holding a sword.
This is so nuts.
But in the end, it always works. Okay, it sometimes works.
You have no idea how happy this makes me.
Personal Best, Season 3. Available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European current affairs program, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
So, Rachel, could you please read this in your most posh, old-fashioned British accent?
There are two things particular to us that contribute much to the beauty and elegance of our gardens, which are the gravel of our walks and the fineness and almost perpetual greenness of our turf.
Beautiful. So that's a line written by Sir William Temple, and I think it highlights something really special about your country, Rachel.
That we have really nice grass?
Yeah, kind of. But there's a reason for that. You've got the climate for it. Not too hot, plenty of rain.
Plenty of rain. Fair enough, I can't deny it.
And that's pretty different to a good chunk of my country.
We're not necessarily anti-lawn here. We just think we have way too much of it. So there's lots of lawn out there that is only walked on when it's mowed. And that's the lawn that we want to get rid of.
That's Sean Moser, who manages something called the Conservation Garden Park, which is where I met him, in a suburb of Utah's Salt Lake City. He explains that as people migrated west over the years, they brought their East Coast landscaping styles with them.
So they wanted to have lawns and big trees and things like that that look like the places that they came from. But as the population has grown and with the amount of water that is given to lawns, it's just not sustainable anymore.
Americans use 8 billion gallons of water a day for residential outdoor spaces, i.e. our lawns and gardens. The local water district has taken a more inspirational approach to cut down on this water use. They built a small botanical garden where people can come to get ideas for how to reimagine their own lawns.
Yeah, so this is Conservation Garden Park. It's here to show businesses, homeowners, how to save water in their landscapes mainly. I think the average residential landscape in Utah that's mostly lawn is 150 to 200,000 gallons of water per season to water that landscape.
That's like a small water tower or 2,000 bathtubs for each lawn every summer. Sean and his team want people to think beyond grass, to reimagine the lawn altogether.
Trees, shrubs, perennials, bulbs, all of those usually use less water than lawn does.
And you know what? Some of these alternatives are way more interesting than a standard strip of grass.
I can point out in this planting bed here that I like. So this is a Mugo pine here. This one's called Karsten's Winter Gold. And then also another one in this area that I like is lavender. It does really well for us here in Utah in the desert. We have some that's been in the garden for 15, 20 years, and we haven't watered it in 15 or 20 years. It's just watered by the rain and the snow. So,
if this sustainable inspiration isn't enough to tempt locals to shake up their gardens, there's also a financial incentive.
Yeah, this year we're offering $3 per square foot of lawn removed, which adds up pretty quickly, so it ends up being a significant boost for people.
Yep, they're paying people to rip out their lawns. Eric Vermel is the conservation supervisor for Jordan Valley Water, and he tells me it's not as simple as replacing your lawn with gravel or rock. You need plants that can actually help the landscape retain water.
It's about replacing it for something that's better for this landscape, and it's also about a cultural shift. And we're also creating attractive environments where you can go out, see birds in your landscape, bring butterflies and pollinators back. I remember this yard being entirely lawn.
It was
entirely lawn, and it was a lot of effort for you to mow and maintain.
Yes, it took a long time to mow. I would actually have to do it in two sessions because I would get so tired from mowing it the first time, then I'd have to go and do the next part of the yard after taking a 15 or 20 minute break.
Do you miss all that mowing?
I really don't.
Eric's brought me to meet Rob Bennett, a homeowner who decided to take up the offer to recreate his yard in a more water-efficient way.
We had to put so much water down to keep all that lawn green that it was just ridiculous. We're saving all kinds of money now, and we're feeling good about making a contribution to the overall water picture for the state.
Today, Rob's garden has a lot more going on than just an empty blanket of uniform grass.
These are the paths as they go through the yard. We have Japanese maples that we were able to put in that are just one of my favorite plants in the world. And then this is the front yard where we took out about half of the lawn and then just put some beautiful granite boulders and other, mulch.
I love the front. It's probably, you know, when people are out walking their dogs, much more to look at than just lawn.
Since we started doing it, everybody in our neighborhood is looking to do it too. So it's a snowball effect.
So does this mean we're entering a new chapter in the story of the lawn?
It kind of looks like it. And it's not just in the US.
I'm not sort of saying that let everything go, although I'm more inclined towards that than I used to be. You know, there is a sort of fashion for wild gardens, which if there's a plant in your garden and you like it, you know, keep it.
That's Ian Thompson again, explaining that grassy patches may be going back to their roots.
We are going back towards the flowering mead. And actually, the suburban garden is one of the places which can be a sanctuary for wildlife. So I think this is all to be encouraged, really.
Flowery mead!
It's making a comeback.
This episode of Don't Drink the Milk was landscape designed by Sam Baker. It was mown over by editor Charlie Shield. Julia Rosa was on archive duty and Katharina Abel took care of fact-checking. I'm host, Rachel Stewart. And if you want to help us grow our garden of listeners, please do leave us a review or do the neighbourly thing and tell one of your friends about us. All in good taste.
What's it about?
It's for our lawns episode.
Oh, well, I have so much more to say about lawns.
Well, I know, but...
Okay, because they're awful. And
I know.
You knew I was going to say grass.
Yep, I did.
Oh. Okay. All right, I love you.
Love you too. Bye.